Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Well, these sure are tough times for the human mind. COVID, war, politics, it's all been a lot to process. That's especially true in schools. Angie Wilcox sees it daily. She's a guidance counselor at Kirksville Elementary in Madison County, and she shared her experience and observations with our education correspondent, Gil Hunter, who wears another hat as interim dean of the College of Education and Applied Human Sciences here at EKU.
Angie Wilcox, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate you taking some time out of your vacation to talk with me, and I appreciate you sharing your expertise as well. First question I have for you as we think about your role as a counselor at Kirksville Elementary is that we've all heard a lot of stories about students and their mental health needs. Those stories and those needs are more apparent than they've ever been. Some of that, of course, is due to the pandemic, but there's also a lot of other factors. In your mind, what's the biggest story, you might say, in student mental health right now?
Thank you for having me. The biggest story for us would be being proactive with social emotional learning. We're looking at curriculum all the time and sharing new ideas about what does it look like when we need to teach the kids skills to deal with everyday life, things that come about that we as adults, you know, can handle, but kids kind of need to be taught those skills. When I talk about social emotional learning, I think about the five components, and we break those down each month and we do lessons on like social awareness, you know, teaching and showing kids how to show and feel empathy for others, relationships, how we can maintain those positive friendships, also self-management, just, you know, being able to set goals and how can I reach my goals, being aware and understanding, you know, what are my feelings right now and how can I handle these emotions that I'm having, making good decisions, all of those skills, teaching them proactively is the biggest story for us right now.
Well, you've mentioned the word proactive twice there, and often when we think about a counselor, we think of that as a reactive position, that someone with a mental health challenge or need will seek out a counselor, and a counselor will kind of help reset or help treat a symptom, whatever it might be. You're talking about proactive. That seems like a real sea change for the way we're thinking about students' mental health. Is that true?
That is true. And feeling like if we're on the proactive end, you won't have to react so much. You know, that's our
sure.
goal there.
Right, right. So that raises the question for me then, what are we seeing addressing it proactively as we're doing between students' mental health and their ability to learn and succeed in school?
One of the biggest things that we've done at Kirksville is we have started morning meetups. And we do this every morning during breakfast. The kids come in, they bring their breakfast, and we just share highs and lows and allow the kids the time to kind of release what they have carried over from home or from the school bus or from the breakfast line to share and kind of get those emotions out. I mean, some days the kids just can't wait to tell you about who won that baseball game last night, or sometimes they want to share a low, you know, mommy's birthday's coming up and she died 3 years ago and she's been on my mind. And the kids start to kind of feel a sense of community also when that happens and kind of normalize those life situations. Well, we're all kind of going through the same things, but they may look a little different. I think if we can start the day like that and get that off their minds in the forefront, then they're ready to learn. You know, when your brain is flooded with emotion, you don't have a lot of learning going on.
Absolutely makes perfect sense. When you describe those morning meetups, I guess that's a time when students talk to their teachers?
They do. They share with the entire class. And they don't always have to share. And some students will want to share privately, but a lot of them will share right out loud, you know, just whatever's on their mind. It's real cute. I've watched a lot of first grade morning meetups this year, and it's so sweet. They have started turning their, well, I had this low, but now it's turning into a high moment.
Yeah.
And it's just so sweet to hear them talk like that.
Absolutely. So I love that idea of community, too. And I can't help but think, to some extent, that might put a burden on teachers. How comfortable do you think teachers are in receiving this information from morning meetups, receiving information from students, meeting students' mental health needs, or even just knowing kind of how to refer students to you or when they should refer students to you or to somebody else?
I do think they're getting more and more comfortable. I think at first we implemented this. I think this is our third year. And we have done a lot of training on this being an active listener and being able to recognize when students just need to talk and get it off their chest, or do they need us to intervene a little more. Teachers are becoming much more comfortable with that as we have done it now, you know, a little longer. But it kind of gives them a chance to, you know, come to me. And then at that point, I can determine, you know, do they just need to talk a little longer? You know, that thought that they had morning meetup is still with them and it's lunchtime. And do I need to intervene, or do I need to call parents or outside agencies to intervene? You know, sometimes that is the case. A morning meetup may not take care of it, but I think they are becoming more comfortable.
Yeah, good. And I'm glad, of course, because we need teachers on the front line that are comfortable and committed to that kind of intervention work. It obviously is a sidestep from the work that they are employed to do, that they thought they were getting into. But we see so clearly how connected student mental health and their ability to focus and to learn is. So if teachers want students to do their best in class, then they have to be able to be kind of that confidant as well.
That is exactly right. I do think, though, that social-emotional learning curriculum has helped them to become a little more comfortable with that, too, because they are doing the lessons with them.
Yeah.
And I think that has kind of helped, too, overall.
So we're tiptoeing around this kind of elephant in the room, I guess, that teachers have mental health needs, too. And I know you're the counselor for students. I assume that some teachers are going to see you as a person that they can confide in or that they can come to and seek support from. I guess if I ask that question in a general way, how are teachers holding up? And what are we doing in schools to help teachers' mental health needs?
I do feel like it's tough on teachers. Technology, you know, allows us to feel like we never turn things off. But I really try to do exactly what I do with the kids, with the teachers. Like, for example, if we have a staff meeting, we do a morning meetup, but it would be a staff meetup. And we talk about our highs and lows, and we get to share. And that always kind of helps that out, too. But I do have different things. I find holidays. I'm trying to think of some. This year, we did a National Popcorn Celebration Day, and I made popcorn, and the principal took it around with some kids, and we delivered it to the teachers. Just, hey, we're popping in to say hello. You know, you're valued. We know how hard you're working.
I love that. And if you'll let me know when you're going to do that next year, then I will be sure and visit Kirksville that day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was this spring. I don't remember which month, but we do different things. We did a chocolate chip day, and Amy Carmichael, our family resource center, we went and we baked cookies and we handed out chocolate chip cookies on that day. Stress Awareness Month, I've talked with New Vista. It's an outside agency that works with some of our kids and comes in and does some outside agency counseling with them. So they came in to our staff one afternoon and did some mindful moments and some relaxation techniques with us, which was really beneficial. The teachers were like, we could do this every month. I'm like, I'm on it. Like, I will do that. So I do plan next year to kind of add some more of those things in. I feel like it's just good for them to kind of take a moment and almost make them relax also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're feeling pulled in so many directions. We're staying so busy. And there are many teachers that will hold that kind of up as a badge of honor instead of kind of recognizing that they need to practice that self-care. And the things you're describing seem kind of small, but they have this big effect.
Right. Very much so.
And I would assume, anyway, that you're teaching some teachers some things that they can then in turn do with their students and their classes.
Yes, those mindful moments. Mm-hmm. A lot of teachers have those help with transitions and morning meetup time going into the start of a, you know, academic content area. A lot of teachers will now use those mindful moments to just take a break. Either they'll turn music on for 2 minutes, you do nothing but listen to music, or We're going to do five-finger breathing and have all the kids take a moment and regulate their breathing and those type things before they transition to the academic part of the day, which are things that we do as adults that we also need to do with our kids.
I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that you're on vacation, and we just finished talking about some relatively small things that people can do for their mental health. Summer creates opportunities for quite large things for people to do. That time of rest and recovery, extracurricular activities, camps, whatever it might be for students. What do you recommend elementary students spend time doing to help their mental health this summer?
I would say, and they would know, Ms. Wilcox would say this, smile more. Go to your happy place. Whether it be, get outside, turn technology off. It's fun for a little while, but get outside, blow bubbles. Color, read, whatever makes you feel just that it's the best part of your day. If it's the best part of your day, you need to do a little bit of it every day. Definitely turning technology off. I do feel like sometimes we get, oh my gosh, we have all this free time. I'm just going to sit here and play my video games or phones or whatever. Well, that's not always going to relax your brain. So
sure. And I guess to be fair, there may not be a large number of elementary students listening to this conversation right now, but their parents probably are.
Right.
How do you help parents kind of coach students or nudge students in that direction?
Well, and talking it out, see what they like. Ask them what was your best part of the day. Just have a moment of talking. Lots of things, turning it off and just sit there for a second. Be an active listener. A lot of kids will talk. We just don't give them the time to talk.
And so finally then, let's not exclude teachers from this part of the conversation either. What are your colleagues doing for their mental health this summer? What kind of rest and recovery activities have you recommended for them, or do you know they're engaging in that are going to let them enter into the fall semester prepared, refreshed, whatever that might be?
I would definitely tell them do the same as we tell the kids to do.
Okay.
They would hear from me, and I would probably tell them to go camping because that would be my rest and relaxation.
Sure. Are you camping? Are you camping right now?
I am camping right now.
Oh, very good. Yeah. So certainly some of them might take you up on that, but whatever it is that they need to do that lets them kind of detach from the day to day helps them, huh?
Yes, their happy place.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, I am happy that we've had this chance to have this conversation. And
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciate your expertise. And I also hope that you enjoy the rest of your vacation. And thank you for carving out a little sliver of it to talk with me today.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Absolutely, Ms. Wilcox. You too. And enjoy your summer. Thank you.
This is Genaro Rascon, who has traveled all over the world showcasing traditional Mexican music. When he brings it home, it's to Berea, where he is an instructor in applied music and traditional instruments at Berea College, as well as director of Mariachi Berea. Welcome, Genaro.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So am I right that you came to Kentucky from California?
That's absolutely correct. I came here in August of 2017 at the behest of Al White, who was the director of the bluegrass and mariachi ensembles at Berea College during that time. Al has since retired, and I took over the mariachi program there at Berea College.
So coming from, I guess, the Imperial Valley of California to Berea, Kentucky must have been quite a culture change, at least.
Absolutely. It couldn't be more different. I suppose the town that I lived and grew up in was a very small town, and so is Berea, and it's similar in that way.
Uh-huh.
But culturally and in most other ways, it's completely different.
Weather, too, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
mariachi and traditional music of Mexico obviously are a huge part of your life, but tell us about that.
Well, I started playing mariachi music in 2008, actually. I didn't grow up in the tradition of it. I kind of stumbled into it. I encountered a mariachi ensemble playing in my hometown, and it captured something in me. Like I was immediately drawn to it, and they were young people like myself. A lot of people tend to think of mariachi music as like older music. It's the traditional music of Mexico, and it's hundreds of years old, and its golden era was in the 1950s. But I saw all these young people playing mariachi music, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. It captured something in me. And I started playing then, and I've been playing steadily since then. It's been, what, now almost 14 years.
Wow. Well, let's sample some of your music. And first, maybe give us a sampling of mariachi trumpet.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
And how about some guitarón? First, if you would describe this instrument for us, it's huge for one thing.
Well, the guitarrón is the base of the mariachi ensemble, and it's actually exclusive to mariachi. It's not used in any other type of ensemble. It's a 6-string fretless bass, and it looks kind of like a guitar. Actually, the word guitarrón literally means the big guitar. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a 6-string fretless bass. It's played in courses. It's got nylon and steel strings, and it sounds like this.
And then you've brought a third instrument with you. Tell us about this one.
So the vihuela is kind of like the smaller cousin of the guitar. So in mariachi ensembles, the armonía or rhythm section is made up mainly of three pieces, which is the classical guitar that everybody knows, the nylon string guitar, the guitarrón that we just showed, and then this instrument is the vihuela. It's the higher end of the mix. It's small, it's 5 strings, and it actually uses what's called reentrant tuning, but people in this area might know it as Nashville tuning. It's an octave higher than a guitar, except for the first 2 strings, which are the same as a guitar. It's 5 strings. It sounds like this. It's mostly percussive, and it sounds like this.
Besides mariachi, what are some other important forms of traditional music of Mexico?
Well, mariachi is actually the prototype of traditional Mexican music. It's called son jarocho, and that was developed in the state of Veracruz and other surrounding areas. And the jarocho groups were usually made up of a small instrument called a jarana and a Mexican harp and sometimes a guitar or vihuela. And a violin. So they would have 3 or 4 pieces. And that developed into the folk music of Mexico was made in those types of groups. And that developed into what became known as mariachi.
I noticed that there's a similarity between mariachi and bluegrass in the rhythm, the chops that happen, especially with, you hear that with the mandolin, you hear it with the guitar.
Absolutely. So it's an interesting thing, an interesting convivir is the word in Spanish. It's a weird relationship, not weird, but it's an interesting relationship that bluegrass and mariachi music have, and that partially they both have European roots. So in mariachi music, we play a lot of polka, which, you know, people will recognize as a 2-4 beat. Boom, bop, boom, bop, boom, bop, boom, bop. That's very, very common in bluegrass and in mariachi. Also, we play a waltz rhythm. In mariachi, it's called a ranchera valseada. But boom, dum, dum, boom, dum, dum, boom, dum, dum, boom, dum, dum. That's European. That came from European settlers. That's the reason why mariachi has classical guitars and trumpets. Those instruments came from Europe.
When you came here, were you thinking maybe there might be some connections with Appalachian culture and ways to kind of infuse the two?
When I came here, no, absolutely not. I had zero, zero knowledge of anything Appalachia. I didn't know any. I came to Kentucky on 2 weeks' notice.
Oh, wow.
When I was presented with the opportunity to help direct this ensemble at Berea College, I didn't know anything about Kentucky. I was living in California. And I saw a posting in a local mariachi musicians message board that we used to use to get work out in Los Angeles. And I just called to inquire. I was like, I wanted to find out more about it. And I ended up having a conversation with Al White. And he sold me on the job. And I was like, okay, this sounds great. Give me some information. And in a couple of months, I'll see about making my way out there. And we can get started on doing this. And he was like, oh, no, the semester starts in 2 weeks. You need to come now.
Wow. Think fast, huh?
Yeah. And it was up to me to make the decision right then. I was like, okay, well, either I'm going to take this position and like get my foot in the door in the world of academia, or I'm going to stay in California and keep doing what I'm doing. And I took the leap of faith and I dropped everything. I dropped everything. I put everything I owned in my car and I drove east.
That's amazing. So what do you think now?
Well, I'm happy to say it worked out. I'm living my best life. I'm working by playing music. Every day I go to work and I play music and I teach people about mariachi, and it feels almost guilty. I shouldn't be getting paid, but I'm glad that they are. I'm very, very happy. I love my job and I love my work and I love living here.
How prevalent would you say traditional Mexican music is in this area?
Well, a lot of people don't realize how much of a thriving Latino community there is in Kentucky. And not just in the bigger areas in, you know, Lexington and Louisville, but all over the state. The majority of farm workers and ranch workers and people in the horse industry are Mexican immigrants. And these people have families and these people have parties. They have birthdays and weddings and other cultural, social gatherings. And with them comes their culture. And there absolutely is a market for traditional Mexican music for cultural gatherings and things like that. And that's where me and my band come in. I play with Mariachi Azteca, which is a professional mariachi ensemble of adults here in Lexington, actually. Aside from the ensemble that I teach at Berea College, who are students, I work with actual professional musicians, and we do, you know, weddings and birthdays and all kinds of cultural events. And we're always steeped in work. There's definitely a market for it, and there's definitely a need for it here in Kentucky.
So if somebody's interested in having that kind of entertainment at their event, they should contact you?
Absolutely. I have no qualms with saying we're the preeminent mariachi in Kentucky.
Good for you.
I also take no qualms in saying we're probably the only mariachi in Kentucky.
And how would they do that? How would somebody reach out to you?
You can find us online. We're on Facebook at Mariachi the Kentucky, or just search Mariachi Azteca. Is it okay if I give a phone number?
I've got
a phone number. Okay.
Well, by all means.
You can call Mariachi Azteca for your event at 859-382-1712, and that's Salvador Aguilar, and he's the director of our group.
All right. That's Hanara Rascon, an instructor in applied music and traditional instruments at Berea College, as well as director of Mariachi Berea.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Hanara.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
This segment featuring Hanara Rascon was produced by our intern Spencer Shook, a music industry major at EKU. His assignment for the summer is to help us bring you world music artists living, working, and performing in Central and Eastern Kentucky. We have more to come. Coming up after the break, tracing a deeper history of the Underground Railroad.
So many of these places that you probably drive by every day have such historic significance that we don't even know about.
And the art of farming.
The magic of living close to the land really started to transform me. And I started needing to address that magic in my art.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops are proud to support Ronald McDonald Houses in Kentucky through sponsorship and volunteerism. More info at www.togetherwesaveky.com. WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker. Provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The Underground Railroad was America's first multicultural, multiracial, inclusive civil rights movement. Alistine Turley writes about it in The Gospel of Freedom, her book about the role of black evangelicals in this secret slave escape system. The book is being published by the University Press of Kentucky. And Dr. Turley, founding director of the Carter G. Woodson Center for Interracial Education at Berea College and the founding director of the Underground Railroad Research Institute at Georgetown College, joins us from her home in Clay City. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Turley.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And we may think we know about the Underground Railroad, but details are continuing to emerge thanks to the work of you and other researchers. And with this book, you raise questions about some long-held beliefs and perceptions about that escape system. What's been missing?
Well, what's been missing for anyone, and it's a good question because there's a great deal missing, but most of the information that's missing is below the Mason-Dixon line. Anyone who researches this information, if you'll look at a Wilbur Siebert map, who is sort of the leading historian, the first one to actually publish something about an Underground Railroad system, all of his escape routes, he's from Ohio, but all of his escape routes begin at the border of Kentucky. So there's nothing that shows you where people from the South were actually escaping from, which is what my text attempts to do.
It's also interesting that your book places enslaved African Americans at the center of their freedom struggle, driven by the determination of an unseen black community. And that would seem to me to be one of those important gaps that you're filling in.
Exactly. Because generally the story that's currently told gives you the impression that white evangelicals from the North came into the South to aid slave escapes. And really that is very limited truth. Very seldom were there very many white evangelicals or any rescuers leaving the North and traveling into a slaveholding South. The ones who did that were very limited. For the most part, if you're escaping slavery in the South, most African Americans are doing that through their own systems of escape.
What was the nature of the religious movement known as the Second Great Awakening, and what was its appeal to both isolated farmers in the backcountry as well as enslaved and free blacks and marginalized whites, women, and children? What was the significance?
The significance of that is the Underground Railroad, the abolitionist movement in general, is considered a religious movement. Mm-hmm. It started with evangelicals from Europe, England primarily, within those 13 colonies. Once the Revolutionary War ended and people began to expand into the backcountry over the Appalachian Mountains into Kentucky and Northwest Territories, they brought with them this belief in equality, humanity, what has been framed by historians as the Enlightenment, period of Enlightenment. And along with that, they promoted religious concepts that did not favor the wishes of the king, but more designed to favor the needs of everyday people. And so the First and Second Great Awakening had a focus on everyday common man, the needs of community, the needs of women, children, poor, those who are suffering. And Kentucky just happened to be the scene of two of the nation's largest revivals, the first one happening over in western Kentucky and along the Gasper and Red River, and the second one, of course, happening right there in Bourbon County in Paris, called at Cambridge, the about 20,000 to 30,000 people who came from all over the central and eastern coast to promote the evangelizing of the West. And part of that had to do with Christianizing the enslaved Africans.
Dr. Turley, very little has been known or written about the ways these systems of freedom operated in the Deep South. And you touched on that earlier in the interview, but I wonder, what are some important revelations that you have discovered about that in your work?
Some of the most important things I discovered was how people traveled in order to make the freedom movement happen in the South. They were not allowed to stay in Kentucky. So in the 1840s and 50s, when Kentucky was purging itself of anti-slavery sentiments, many of the anti-slavery workers that were ousted from the state simply went across the river into border places like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. And this is how the myth of the Underground Railroad developed. It gives the appearance that these folks were coming from the north to the south, but really, in many cases, these were expelled Kentuckians who actually went north and didn't give up their anti-slavery sentiments, but simply set up shop across the Ohio and Mississippi rivers in order to enable people to be assisted. So it was fun documenting these locations and find out how many of them had been former Kentuckians.
Well, Dr. Turley, you and others like you who are doing this work are literally filling in gaps. And we've alluded to that a couple of times in our conversation here. But the larger picture is, looking at it from 30,000 feet up, is that there is a much broader American history yet to be discovered.
Yet to be discovered. And the fact that so many of these places that you probably drive by every day have such historic significance that we don't even know about. For example, there in Lexington, you have Masterson Station and Masterson Station Park. But I doubt very seriously if anyone ever talks about the role of the Mastersons in promoting an abolitionist agenda here in Kentucky. Or if anyone talks about the history of churches and schools and colleges and how they provided educated leadership for the abolitionist movement here in Kentucky and how many of them either lost property or lost their citizenship rights here in Kentucky because of it.
Is that history now being properly documented?
I'm hoping that my book will inspire young students and researchers and other scholars to really take the time. My book is only meant to give you, to drop some threads of research, hopefully that others will pick up, because there's quite a bit that needs to be explored. One person cannot do it. But hopefully the book is interesting enough that people will become curious and decide to develop their own research projects in their own particular communities or institutions and organizations. I think they may be fascinated by what they find.
You dedicate the book to your great-grandparents, to Moses and Susan Turley. Their struggles were the basis for your work. Tell us about Moses and Susan Turley.
I grew up here in eastern Kentucky as a young child on the farm of my grandparents, which is, we would always visit here in the summer. And before any of the children ever went home, we always had to hear this story of Moses and Susan. They were escaped slaves on the Underground Railroad. And my great-grandfather, Moses, was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. That was the story. But then when I got old enough to go to college, and one day I decided to tell this story at the end when we went back to school in summer, and how people just had a hard time believing it. They kept saying, oh, that's not true. That's just a story. And so it wasn't until I became a college student that I had an opportunity to really research, starting with these two people in my own family, trying to discover whether the story was fact or fiction. And that basically led me to so many strings of history that I was able to pick up and create this book.
Well, we're grateful that you did. And I recommend that everybody pick it up and read it and catch up on this history, because it's essential to understanding where we are and who we are. Dr. Alastine Turley, author of The Gospel of Freedom, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thank you, Dr. Turley.
Thank you.
Kate Savage from Arts Connect in Lexington is back with a guest who's a living bridge between the hard realities of farming and the wonders of art.
Alwyn Donahue lives on a farm in Kentucky, where her family has raised produce for local markets for over 20 years. Her comics and graphic stories have been featured in The Nib, The Rumpus, The Indiana Review, and the forthcoming Field Guide to Graphic Literature. She's received grants from the Sustainable Arts Foundation, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, the Kentucky Humanities Council, and an Al Smith Fellowship from the Kentucky Arts Council. Her hybrid memoir art book, titled Landings, A Crooked Creek Farm Year, with an introduction by New York Times bestselling author Barbara Kingsolver, is scheduled for release this year in October. Through Alwyn's 130 ink and watercolor drawings, the story of 1 year on a family farm in Kentucky unfolds in captured moments of daily life, with each illustration paired with a written reflection. Kingsolver says in her introduction, "Generational memory seems to have fed a modern assumption that manual labor is for the wretched and a farm life is something to be escaped." We shall talk about how Alwyn has found meaning in life as a farmer and how she has managed to combine the art of farming into the art of storytelling and picture making. So thank you for being with us today, Alwyn.
Thank you, Kate.
A little bit about you. Do you in fact come from a farming background, or have you had to learn how to dig in the soil and be a farmer?
Yes, I do not come at all from a farming background. It's quite foreign to my family experience, but I am learning, and I would say I'm still a beginner, and it's quite likely that I'll always be a beginner.
Well, that sounds very humble. You've been doing it for 20 years, so I'm sure you've picked up a few tricks.
A few.
But along the way, you've obviously started to draw and write about your daily life. How did that come about?
Well, really, I'd say it was sort of a technical thing in the beginning. I wanted to get better at painting with watercolors because at the time I was working on a project for which I had been interviewing writers, and I wanted to start making portraits of the people I was interviewing. And I thought, oh, I'll just start drawing my daily life for a year and then I'll get better at painting. So that was how it started.
Sounds a little bit like some of those people who take the 30-day challenge and give themselves 10 minutes every day to draw something.
Yeah, it was a little like that.
Yeah,
it definitely took more than 10 minutes a day. But
well, I guess the time was flexible. You could decide how long you wanted to give yourself. But I remember seeing that was sort of a fad for a while. But so talk about how your art has become a way for you to escape from the demands of farming and how this book that you've written, Landings, A Crooked Creek Farm Year, has allowed you to sort of face or to confront your farming life head on.
Yeah, that's been an interesting long process. My husband, David Wagoner, and I moved from Washington, D.C. to our Kentucky farm in the late 90s, so more than two decades ago. And I had a background in the arts at the time and arrived on the farm pretty determined not to get swallowed by the farming life. I had always wanted to be an artist and a writer, and I thought, oh, I'll just move to the country and live an inexpensive life and devote as much time as possible to art and writing. And at the time, land around these parts was a lot cheaper than it is now. So we were able to find this land for not much money. And it was kind of my husband's ancestral home place. So that was meaningful. And people who knew better, who knew what it meant to get into running a farm, would kind of chuckle knowingly and say, oh, you're going to find out what's involved in this. And of course, it was true. I really did learn the demands of keeping a small farm afloat, and that did make it very difficult for me to keep up with my artistic practice. But I was stubborn about it, and I still am stubborn about it, and I did keep up with my art. My artistic practice was often usurped by my farming life, so I did kind of try to push the farming away when I was doing my art and sort of felt rebellious about it. And the thing that changed over time is that the magic of living close to the land really started to transform me. And I started needing to address that magic in my art. But like I said, I didn't really realize that that was happening until I started drawing my daily life here. You know, sometimes you just don't know what you're doing until you start doing it.
And so you sort of found a way to capture it all on paper. You talk about farming, and I just want to be sure that anyone listening to the show today realizes that you weren't weekend farmers. This is farming for a living, farming for a livelihood. So it wasn't anything that you could actually really avoid.
That's right.
So obviously farming in Kentucky has its challenges. How did the pandemic, in fact, exacerbate some of these for you?
Well, things had kind of changed for us. Our situation on the farm had changed by the time the pandemic rolled around. So by then, we had been doing a community-supported agriculture program for 18 years. And then there was a personal tragedy in our family, and it just everything, there was a lot of upheaval in the years right before the pandemic hit that just caused me to have to move to Lexington for a while. But the pandemic was basically, it shook us up. We were very lucky that we didn't get sick. And by then, our farm production was mostly going to Weta Michaels restaurants. And there was some upheaval there, but it settled down and we've managed to ride it out. But just to say something about the challenges of being a farmer very quickly, it is really challenging. Industrialized agriculture, of course, has lowered the price of food. And of course, everyone should be able to afford good food, but our food system pays for the artificially low price of food by abusing the land and the people who work on the land. And the only way for small, diversified farms to survive is if there are people out there who recognize their value and are willing to support them. And we were really lucky to have a community of people who recognize the value of that here in central Kentucky. So we're very grateful.
And I think the sustainability movement is something that maybe has gathered speed over the years, and you were already kind of on that train. So
yes, yeah, that's true.
Your earlier multimedia project, Rooted Words, gave natural birth to your book, Landings. But tell us a little bit about this earlier work, Rooted Words. Nice title, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, I touched on that a little while ago when I said that I started drawing Landings because I wanted to learn how to do portraits. And I thought that would teach me something about the watercolor medium that I had settled upon. So I was really amazed after moving to Kentucky by the sort of earthbound wisdom of the writers I met here. I started meeting and reading their work and felt really curious about them and their lives because the collective wisdom here is something really extraordinary. It's the kind of wisdom that I believe the world really needs to hear and learn more about. It's this deep land-based knowledge that's fused with this vibrant and inventive artistry. And there's just so many writers here who have that sensibility. So I wondered, where does that relationship between land and language come from in these people's work, and what are the stories behind it? And I started doing in-depth oral histories to explore these questions. And after about 10 years of work, I interviewed 15 writers about their place and their work and where they grew up and started doing paintings. And then the exhibit premiered in 2018 at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center in Lexington. And then in November, the exhibit is actually going to travel to the Barry Center in Newcastle, Kentucky. And the plan is that the paintings will be auctioned off at that point, and half the proceeds from their sale will benefit the Barry Center, and the other half will be donated toward a memorial for Bell Hooks. And this feels very fitting to me because Wendell Berry and Bell Hooks were two key inspirations for the whole project.
Well, in fact, that's kind of a great segue into my next question, because I was going to ask you that I know many Kentucky writers share a profound experience and respect for the land and rural culture, just as you do. And I was going to ask you, who are some of those writers that you most admire? And the Berry Center is a reference to the Wendell Berry that we all know and love, which is up there in Henry County, mm-hmm. and then Bell Hooks, who just recently passed away. But you must have some others that you also consider to be mentors.
Yes, really too many to name. One, apart from Bell Hooks and Wendell Berry, would be my dear friend Marianne Taylor Hall, who not as many people know about her work who as should. She's a brilliant novelist and poet. I really love her work. Bell Hooks is fascinating to me, partially because the range of her work. Her work is so rooted in her reverence for land-based ways of life, and I don't think people realize that, like how she would have had. I don't think she would have had such a clear understanding of the effects of what she called imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy if she did not have such a clear understanding of the relationship between people and land. And then Crystal Wilkinson is another person whose work I've loved and admired, and I've learned so much from. She grew up on a farm, and her deep knowledge about the rhythm of the land and rural culture and the pernicious effects of racism permeate her work. And of course, she's now our poet laureate.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just a few. I could go on and on.
I'm sure. The list is long indeed. You mentioned Weta Michael a couple of times, and Weta has just a whole quiverful of local restaurants that boast of organic and locally produced food, for which you are one of the suppliers. And she is another creative Kentuckian who's devoted to shedding light on the connections between food, farming, art, and culture. And she's just recently started a new documentary series, Up Home, another great title. And you're involved with that, Arwen, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yes. And you're absolutely right. Weta knows those connections deep down in her bones between art and food and farming. So it's really a delight to be working with her and filmmaker Harrison Witt to create art for the series. Yeah, I created the title card and some paintings for each episode. As far as I know, they're putting up links to each episode on the Holly Hill and Company website, and then the series is, I think it's based on YouTube.
Like, okay.
You can just go watch it on YouTube. Okay. And each episode is short. It's about, each one is about 6 minutes long or so. So it's digestible.
So just kind of finally, how do you balance the pursuit of creative freedom with a concern for sustainability as well as land stewardship?
That's a really good question. It's something that I have puzzled over a lot. And for me, I feel like I just have to kind of battle against the forces that tell me that in order to lead a successful life, I have to be constantly seeking out more and bigger and better and flashier, and that I have to accept limits and accept that we live on a planet that has limits. But I feel that there really can be great freedom and joy in accepting those limits, and that for me personally, the creative growth happens from being rooted in a place and paying attention to its cycles and its other forms of life. There's a lot of joy in that, and healing too, I'd say.
It sounds as if you found a wonderful place of peace. We've been talking with Arwen Donohue, a writer and artist whose new book, Landings, A Crooked Creek Farm Year, will be published by Hub City Press this October. Thanks for joining us, Arwen.
Thank you so much, Kate.
From Arts Connect for Eastern Standard, I'm Kate Savage.
We've talked often about the immediate need for reliable and strong connections to the internet in eastern Kentucky. Well, there's word that up to $1 billion, that's with a B, could be coming Kentucky's way to boost access to high-speed internet service. Lisa Autry fills us in.
The 2021 General Assembly committed $300 million from the American Rescue Plan Act to expand broadband to underserved counties. State Budget Director John Hicks says Kentucky may be eligible to receive much more through the federal government's Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program.
An estimate says that Kentucky could receive up to $700 million, which in this estimate was about 23rd most of the 50 states.
Hicks addressed the legislature's interim Appropriations and Revenue Committee in Frankfort. He said the Commonwealth is in the process of applying for a portion of the $37 billion that will likely be distributed to states early next year. I'm Lisa Autry in Bowling Green.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Eastern Standard, and in next week's show, another of our 10-minute radio plays. These are performances written by Kentuckians, directed and produced by Kentuckians, and acted by Kentuckians. Up next...
May I get you something to drink? Water with lemon, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Would Herb like something to drink? Herb? Herb? Herbert!
Hmm?
Would you like something to drink, sir?
Well, I don't drink.
Bring him a sweet tea, please, Mary Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Herbert? Herbert? Herb!
No reason to shout, dear. I'm right here.
Herb? Oh, hell. Mary Lee, would you please bring us a high chair and some strained pears, please? I'll be right back, Herb.
Where'd she go?
Strained Pears, a radio play written by the host of our series on Kentucky theater production, Bill McCann, directed by Alana Gent, an associate professor in the EKU theater program, sound designed by our own Neil Kesterson and Tammy Ray, and starring Deborah Martin, chair of the theater department at Berea College, and a name and voice that may ring a bell, Kentucky Humanities director and Think History host, Bill Goodman. On 88.9, next Thursday at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., Sunday at 6 p.m., and available on demand on esweku.org. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Spencer Shook, intern, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, and you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. And you can find us at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and on NPR One and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.